Life is not a game. If it is, it's just not checkers. In checkers, you have to jump over another piece of another color in order to move two spaces forward, as opposed to one space forward, towards the other side of the board in order to become king. The king is allowed to move across the board freely. For some people, that is what life is like for them. A person who is poor and is surrounded by poverty, who stepped on and over anyone to get rich. To a poor person, being rich is like being king. I learned how to play checkers at a young age, like most boys. And like everything I learned, I became very good at it. Later in life, I'd be taught the game of chess in prison. I was arrested 15 minutes from Albany on the Albany Thruway. I was found in possession of 108 vials of crack cocaine on August 16, 1990. In the car I was in, I was a passenger and was pulled over. Excuse me. Ironically, when the car came to a halt, the work we had stashed under the dashboard fell to the floor. I had no choice but to pick it up and stash it in my underwear before the state trooper made it to the window asking me for my ID. When the state trooper returned to the car with my ID, I already knew what was next. A warrant back in New York City. I had a few open cases. One of them was a false arrest. Maybe I'll write about that. So the state trooper ordered me out the car. He began searching me. When he pulled the pack out of my pants, he pushed me up against the car and ordered me, my partner, not to move. We were both in handcuffs and put in the back of the state trooper car. To make a long story short, I took that one for the team. I copped out, pled guilty to 203rd December upstate. I arrived at Wyoming Correctional Facility in February of 1991. I took drafting as a trade because they housed close to the mess hall in B Block. When I arrived at the medium facility in back of Maximum Security Attica, I was housed in H Block, the last houses in the facility, about a mile, maybe more, from the mess hall. So B Block is where I first learned how to play chess. I was taught by the best chess player I ever seen in my life. Everyone called him OT. I guess that means old timer. He was like an old giant. He would sit across the table with his legs crossed and he would pick up his pieces with his freakishly long fingers and drop them in the next square gently. Meanwhile, talking to his opponent, not to start his opponent, but to teach you while he beat you. I watched him play opponent after opponent. He never lost and had many different ways to win. He never hesitated when it was his move. He never would waver from his plan of attack. No matter what move his opponent would make, it was as if his opponent's moves were all calculated into his plan of attack. As he moved in on his opponent's king, he would drop precious jewels along the way. His words were like gems you could take with you, shine for life. One of my favorite was, think five times before you move. I applied this one to my life. I began to think five times before I would speak. By doing this, I became a much better listener, and I began to learn more about how the other people think and feel. We go from boys to men, then back to boys again. We do this again and again. Then when I was 10, about to be 11, because I was born at the end of September, and the school year started September 8th, I was always the oldest in my class, as well as the smartest. That never stopped me from doing some dumbish. Growing up in the projects, we were told to stay close to your building. That meant the front of the building or the back of the building and the park. Every builder had its own park. Every builder had its own park and they were all different. My building was 3050 or 3050, building number 7. We had the worst park. Ours was the worst, then 3080, building number 8. All we had was monkey bars and a king chair. If it wasn't for the skelly board that we painted on the ground to play that amazing game that Bronx created called Skelly Game. Also called Skelly's, Scummy Tops, or Cats. But widely known as Scummy. It's a children's game played on the streets of New York City and other urban areas stretched out on the streets, usually in chalk. A skelly board allows a game for 2 to 6 players. A sidewalk is sometimes used, offering greater protection from vehicular traffic. However, the asphalt on a typical street in New York is smoother and provides better gameplay than a bump concrete sidewalk. Game time varies, but a match of 2 to 3 players is usually completed in 20 minutes. Local rules vary in common and make difficult to document the game. Variations of rule are agreed upon by the players before starting the game, especially when players from different neighborhoods play against each other. Really, I was just bored with busting ass and skellies in my park, so I started going to other parks, playing other dudes, and meeting people all over the hood. That's probably why I'm cool with my whole hood. Or maybe it was because I dropped a classic hip-hop record in 1993 called Hide Your Gap. Playing chess wasn't the only thing I did while I was in prison. I also learned how to play poker. But even learning how to play poker taught me a hard life lesson. Hard life lessons are lessons you learn in life, that if you learn them soon enough in life, it decreases your chances of living a hard life in the future, or sometimes whether you have a future. The lesson I learned was money on the wood made the game go good. In other words, I learned not to gamble because I'm not good at it. Also, and most important, I learned don't make a bet you can't cover. It takes a long story short. The guys who taught me how to play Texas Hold'em were pretty upset when it came time to cover the commissary bet list I had because of my losses at the table. But God is good, because I never really found out just how upset they were, because I was on a draft headed to Gladiator School Green, medium correctional facility. I dodged that one, but I would later learn that life was my life was spared, but it went further downhill from there. I don't really like to talk about prison life because it's mostly boring and forgettable. From my experiences, that is, but most of all, I wouldn't want to come off as glorifying it in any way to anybody. I did time in Albany County, Rikers Island, and I went up north 3 times. I was classified as a red ID. After I left my first facility, Wyoming, in 91, Red ID means I was considered a threat to officers and inmates in any facility I landed. I was housed around the most violent felons, and I spent a lot of time on keep lock and even special housing unit on 23/7 lockdown. I didn't like this classification at all, but I had earned it. Like most inmates with Red ID, I put in my share of work. I didn't look for trouble, but I didn't back down ever. I never told on anyone in my life. In fact, I did time in SHU for a dude I didn't even know, who tossed a sword-like shank under my cell door when they came for a search on F1 key block in Caxackie Correctional Facility. I stood on my own 10 toes at first when I got knowledge of self. I was guard at one time. I was the homie at one time. By the time I did my last bid, I was back to my boyhood self, Hakeem Wali, a boy who was born a Muslim. When I came home after my first bid, I had a new talent. I knew how to rap. I was good at it. At least I believed I was. As well as a lot of inmates I battled in prison. And the inmates who told me I better never come back to jail with the talent I got. In other words, use it to stay out. I was chilling with my friend Maine, who they now call Sweets. Ain't nothing sweet about him, about my dog, you know what I'm saying? I don't know how he got the name, but I do know he is the reason they know me as Hockey D to this day. I just told him one day, yo, I know how to rap. Nah, he just came up with a name out of nowhere instead of asking me. He said, what's your name, Hockey D? I said, hell no. I hated it at the time, but he made sure it stuck, and I believe I've grown used to it. I always felt it made me look like a corny MC, but I guess I got enough talent to make my counterparts know I'm really a dangerous MC. When I came home, I knew I would get with my oldest brother, Wayne, DJ Smash. He was into music since as far back as I could remember. I don't remember how we linked up because he was hardly ever around. But we linked up and I started working on music. After a few sessions of spitting long freestyles, my brother taught me the math behind every song. My brother told me his wife at the time, named Asia Love, wanted to give me some bread to make a single for the distributor at Freeze Records. I walked out of Caxackie Correctional Facility around May 1993. I did two things as soon as I came home. I met my wife, Aisha, who gave me three beautiful children, and I went to the studio and became a hood legend when I dropped Hide Your Gap. I was the rap rookie who took over the summer of 1993. I've been on top of my game ever since. Constant elevation causes expansion. I write rhymes while I cool in my mansion. Fast forward to 2020. The year we used to call the future. We used to imagine what we would be doing as a person and as a society, as a whole. We used to believe in a cartoon images of the future we saw on cartoons like the Jetsons. As we grew older and experienced the harsh realities of life, we began to believe the images of the future like Star Wars, Terminator, Escape from New York, and the most popular trilogy of all time, The Matrix. So many experiences I call them layers, because I've learned from all my life's experiences. And I elevated, rose above whatever I gave me, because whatever life gave me because I chose to do things the hard way. I was a young black male. Like most kids in the projects, my dad was not around for guidance. So I made a conscious effort to be there for my children. I didn't want my children growing up the way I did without a father. I'm proud of all my children. Even though I've been separated for more than 12 years, I still have a good relationship with their mom. We keep things cool and peaceful for the most part. I met someone who I've been with for almost 12 years. We have a daughter, Alicia, together. She's 10 years old and an amazing. We have raised her son together since he was 3 months old. His name is Joshua. He's 12 and also amazing. I call them the amazing J&A. It was love at first sight for me. I was hooked before I met her. I saw her in a picture and I knew I wanted to meet her. I saw a son who was such a beautiful baby, I knew I had to meet her. So when my friend sent me upstairs to where I knew she would be, it was destined to happen, and it did. We were inseparable from the day we met. And when things got rough and they tried to separate us, we made a vow that we wouldn't let no one break us up if it ain't us. Even when we found out she had a brain tumor the size of a grapefruit in her head, I was there. After her surgery, she went completely blind. I was there. At the shelter, I was there on 95th Street in Clarkson, where my daughter had 45 lead poison. I was there. It's been hard these past 11 and a half years. More hard times than good. I won't even reflect on it all right now because the hardest year of my life was 2019. It began the night of December 19, 2018. After witnessing my lady suffer through multiple seizures, I finally called the ambulance against her wishes. We all got dressed and went to Lincoln Hospital. It was awful watching all these doctors and nurses scrambling to help my lady. She was barely dressed, but I would tell myself not to worry about such things. They were here to help. Save people's lives, that's what they do. But in the back of my mind, me and her both know that when it comes to seizures, as well as most others, illnesses, the emergency room don't either care or they really don't have no idea of what to do with her. She began refusing hospitalization from ambulance workers after being taken to the emergency room and ending up on the side wall somewhere to be forgotten about. She's a blind woman for one. Someone could kidnap her. And then number two, they don't know anything factual about seizures. Number three, if me and the kids don't come with her, then she has to go blind and alone. By the time morning came, she had been put into an induced coma because she was in what they call a seizure state of consciousness. She could be up and active, but unaware of any of the events. I told the doctor I would take my children home and would return when I got a babysitter. I called a couple numbers trying to get someone to watch them, but no one was there. For as usual, my eldest daughter Ashanti, who was home from college, came to the rescue and babysat for me while I went back to the hospital. I was calling the hospital all day to check in on my lady. I even tried to come back with the kids with me to check in on her. But the lady at the front desk would not let me in, not even for 5 minutes. She said something about she wouldn't want me to leave my kids nowhere I told her I didn't even intend to do that anyway. I'll be back. She better hope nothing happens to her. In the meanwhile, me and my kids left. I felt like that last part was taken out of context. But oh well. When I returned to the emergency room, the lady gave me a visitor sticker. It's not a problem this time, but I swear I wasn't back more than 10 minutes with my lady when I got a text from my daughter, Shanti, saying the ACS was at my door questioning her. My lady had been taken out of the induced coma state, but I could tell she was in and out of her seizure state. She was not quite herself. And I let the doctor know when he came he wanted her to do an MRI. So I just put my phone away, and I couldn't deal with that issue right now. I knew my daughter was of legal age to babysit a brother and sister. I knew my rights. I must have dozed off and took a nap waiting for the doctor to come. For the MRI, I was awakened by the sound of an uncaring voice telling me, "You gotta get out." I opened my eyes slowly to see who it was. I could tell she was a woman, but she was talking to me like a man who had some type of authority. Like when a correction officer addresses an inmate at the SHOP program, I call it disrespectful. I say, "Who are you?" She said, "I gotta clean up over there." That's when my lady woke up. She was back. I knew because she called me babe. She said she was cold and wet. She said she needed a shower because she was feeling pissy. She could hardly speak because she had bitten her tongue up so much. So it was just breaking my heart to hear her talking the way she was. I damn near cried. And here comes this uncaring voice again saying, "Anyway, I need to clean up over there." I looked at her and I asked her, "Did you hear her? Because she was talking to you." I told her, "I don't care about over there." And then I pointed to the other side, two corners of the room, and said, "Over there and over there." And I said, "If you're not cleaning her up, then you're not cleaning anything in here." She looked at me and she sort of looked in my eyes. She sort of pained it. She said, "I'm getting out of here." And she left out of the room so fast. She didn't even realize she had got out and called security at the same time. I told her to get my lady some sheets. She said, "I'm not going back in there." I said, "Now you want to act childish." I began looking for sheets. I found the whole stack. I began to open them up and put them over my lady. She curled up under a ball of sheets and went back to sleep. The doctor did not want me to get thrown out, but he knew security was on the way to do just that. So he took me to the other side of the emergency room and started asking me questions about my lady, medical history. When security showed up, they didn't see me any commotion and no one was snitching, so they just turned around and went back to their post. The doctor asked me to help him get my lady to the MRI room. I said, "Let's do it." We both wheeled the gurney out of the emergency room, and by the time we reached the x-ray room and radiology, I realized now I had a partner in crime. His name was Dr. Pete, and we were in charge of the situation.